From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, telepathy, UFOs, near-death experiences, singularity, human consciousness. Boy, we're going to have it all for you. But here is what's happening. Two people have died. More than 300 others have fallen ill after eating imported cucumbers, of all things, tainted with salmonella. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 341 people affected across 30 states. That's a huge jump since September 4, when only 56 cases were reported. 70 people have been hospitalized. Now, the outbreak of salmonella linked to cucumbers imported from Mexico, distributed by a company called Andrew and Williamson Fresh Produce. The bulk of the cases have been reported in California. One person died, 71 others infected there. Israel, according to Iran's supreme leader, will not survive the next 25 years. He has said this in a series of threatening remarks, including death to America. In a quote posted to Twitter, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei addresses Israel, saying, "You will not see the next 25 years," and adds that the Jewish state will be hounded until it is destroyed. Meanwhile, we're still working, of course, on the nuclear deal with them. A world-renowned Ohio State University professor who had access to restricted defense information as part of his work with NASA is under investigation now by the FBI for failing to disclose his ongoing connections to Chinese scientists. Professor Rongxing Li, 56 years old, resigned from his position back about a year ago. He told the university that he was going back to China to take care of his sick mother. No one has heard from him since. But he had ties to Chinese scientists. Very strange story there. And China is planning the very first ever landing of a lunar probe on the far side of the moon. The mission is planned for sometime before 2020. It's alive, or that's what scientists might say when they reanimate the so-called Frankenvirus. It's a 30,000-year-old giant virus that was discovered in Siberia. The French researchers behind this warned that the climate change could reawaken the dangerous microscopic pathogens. Since 2003, the virus is now the fourth kind of a prehistoric virus unearthed overall and the second one discovered by this research team. Gary Ridenour, an expert on pandemics with us. Gary, what if they unleash something horrible with this virus?
Well, that is the problem with this. This virus is one-tenth the size of a red blood cell, and that's why they call it the Frankenvirus, because it's so huge, and it has 500 genes inside of it, where our influenza virus only has 7 genes. And this thing has been, 30,000 years in the ground, and we don't know what it is or what does it do. And this is like a sci-fi movie. They're going to reactivate this thing, and they may end up killing millions of us.
That's scary stuff, isn't it? Jeez.
It is. And as Siberia becomes more of a cesspool, new diseases, may wake up and break out across the planet.
All right, Gary, thank you so much. We'll watch this story. Now, you all know about the late Harry Houdini, the great escape artist. Well, an escape artist who tried to outdo Houdini by being buried alive in handcuffs underneath 6 feet of soil, almost died underground while trying to escape. Antoni Britton from England had hoped to go one better than Harry Houdini by escaping unaided after being handcuffed and buried in a standard-sized grave under the planet. Deep in the earth, not under the planet. But the stuntman had to be hauled out unconscious by crew members after he failed to break through the surface almost 9 minutes into his escape bid. He was taken by ambulance to a hospital, given oxygen. He later came around. Well, it is kind of ironic that troubles in the healthcare are showing up everywhere. Now, even as public awareness of mental illness increases, guess what? There's a shortage of psychiatrists all over the country. our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Breggin, with us. Peter, how come people aren't becoming psychiatrists? What's going on?
Well, George, you know, people go to medical school. They want to be scientific, and they want to help people. And my profession of psychiatry is not scientific, and it's not helping people. So your best folks are just staying away from psychiatry. And in a way, that's a blessing, George, because all the psychiatrists do now is drug people, shock people, and lock people up. This profession of mine is at a dead end.
It is dying. Now, let me ask you something. If you were going through medical school again, would you become a psychiatrist?
Probably not. I might have become a pediatrician. I love pediatrics, and I probably would have been in a whole different kind of field. But I wanted to be a psychiatrist. I had hopes that psychiatry would continue developing the psychological and social approaches that work, and that we still know scientifically that work, and work with the most distressed people. I didn't know that the drug companies and psychiatry were just going to become partners. It's really dreadful. So think about who would go into psychiatry now. You know, we used to joke in my day, George, that a psychiatrist was a Jewish medical student who couldn't stand blood. And I'm Jewish, of course, and there's a little truth to that. But mostly people who went into psychiatrist in my day learned that therapy helped. They learned that maybe they had therapy, and they decided they wanted to help people. But who's going in now? It's people who see their colleagues drugging people into stuporous states and calling it treatment. They see electroshock on the rise. So the good people aren't going in anymore.
That's kind of scary because there is that shortage. Peter, thanks so much. One of Peter's books, Medication Madness. Up next, we're going live to Italy. We're going to hang on the border of Slovenia. Robert Young Pelton is with us, and we're going to talk about world events for a few hours next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Over the next couple hours, we're going to be talking with Robert Young Pelton, one of our favorite guests, about issues that are affecting the entire planet. Now, you may not seem that it's affecting you here at home, but there's a crisis happening all over Europe with migrants, primarily leaving Syria because of the civil unrest there. And they're just fleeing. They're leaving their homes. They're leaving their places, residence. They're leaving their businesses. And they are going to other countries. Now, the Eastern Europeans and the European Union are trying to figure out, what do we do with all these thousands and thousands of people? Do we take them in or don't we? Some countries like Germany have been very good with this. France, Spain, others have not. It's a big issue, but there's a lot of things going on. So Robert Young Pelton, of course, noted author, adventurous, one of his books, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, is with us. Robert, what an incredible situation going on. The entire world seems to be upside down.
Well, good morning, good evening, George. Right now, we have about 59 million people that are considered displaced by the UN, and that's both internally and externally displaced people. But that's the highest number since World War II. So, yes, you're getting this feeling. It has monopolized the front pages of all the major newspapers around the world. So, yeah, it's a crisis.
And this is amazing with technology, too, Robert. I mean, here you are in Italy on the border of Slovenia. You're talking to us via Skype, and, I mean, you're thousands of miles away, and, you know, it sounds like you could be in a room down the hall.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that because people, you know, I'm working with Migrant Offshore Aid Station, which is a ship that rescues people that are in risk of drowning in the Mediterranean, but people always ask me, why do people leave their homes and why are they coming to Europe? It's because of the globalization of the Internet. People can communicate, they can see what's happening all around the world, and they want that. So if their relatives are in Sweden or Germany and they say, hey, come on, I got a job in a pizzeria, it'll pull people from all around the world, you know, all the way from Africa, Middle East, etc. So that's what's happening, is the globalization of borders.
Robert, tell us what's going on in Syria to force these people to flee their homes and to go elsewhere. So what is really happening there?
Well, you remember the Arab Spring, in which a number of countries, beginning with Tunisia in 2010, had strongman dictators. And what people probably don't realize is in these strongman countries, they had subsidized food, they had subsidized fuel, and people were basically working for the government or in menial jobs, and they were sort of, I guess, happy because they had very little. And then the oppression began, and they began to rise up, and then they started protesting, and then in many countries, like Libya, they rose up and started fighting. So you had Egypt, you had basically the entire North African, Middle East exploded. So you had the same situation in Syria, and in most cases, either you put down this revolt very quickly, or the leader resigned or had some kind of reforms. In this case, Assad took a page from his father's playbook and decided to get tough and basically wipe out what he thought was a small group of Sunni fundamentalists. His father had done that in the 80s and basically wiped out the city of Hama, mm-hmm. as an example. But what happened is the Syrians were very resilient. The Syrians are very intelligent, educated people. They also have military skills, and they fought back. And then you had other people getting involved in this war. So you have a stalemate. You have 9 million people, 9 million Syrians, that are not in their homes, that are sitting in camps in neighboring Turkey and Lebanon and places like that. And for 4 or 5 years, they've been sitting. And these people want to go home. They don't want to sit in my home. They want to sit in their home. So after a while, all the Syrians that I meet in Libya and places like that say, I can't live like this. So they end up going to Europe or places where they can get jobs.
When ISIS became a serious threat, they were the ones that were trying to get Assad out. So weren't they friends of ours initially, and didn't we support them?
Yeah, now you make me explain all this complex history, but the story of ISIS is very interesting because in the Iraq war, we overthrew Saddam Hussein, who had favored the Sunni Ba'athists. These were the people in power. And the Shias, who we promised to assist in their revolution, were mostly down south, were repressed. So when we went in there in 2003, we decided to flip the whole thing around and oppress the Sunnis, basically wiping out the Ba'ath Party, all the pensioners, all the military, mm-hmm. and promoting the Shia. Now, that created the reverse effect, where the Shia began oppressing the Sunnis. And it wasn't until General Petraeus came in that he said, hey, why don't we just pay the Sunni militias, which were the what they call the Anbars, you know, along the river there.
That's right.
Next to Syria, to defend their own towns against these Shia death squads. And we began the surge, or what they call the awakening. And the Anbars are very smart people. They've always had control. They control the trade between Syria and the ocean. So that pacified Iraq long enough for us to say, okay, let's get out of here. Now, you remember there was a problem with Blackwater and the use of contractors mm-hmm. in Sir Square in 2007. Well, at that time, Maliki, who's a Shia, refused to sign. Hold on. refused to.
I hope that's your other phone.
Yes, it is. Don't worry. I'm just going to turn it off.
Okay.
Maliki refused to sign the Status of Forces Agreement, which would have allowed American troops to stay there because of the Blackwater shooting. What happened then is we decided not to get engaged in a serious way in Iraq, and he went to Iran. And, of course, you had the same Shia-Sunni split again,
right.
Except once again the Shia were on top. Iran told him to stop paying the Anbaris. The Anbaris then went to what was al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they went into Syria where they got free weapons, they got training, they got lots of fighters. They got into it with al-Nusra, who was actually the al-Qaeda group, and then went back into Iraq and took control over the oil installations in the north and became very wealthy, and that was the beginning of ISIS. So that's a very long story in history of ISIS.
And now the Russians are entering Syria, and I think they're going to get in there, Robert, in a big way, not just with cargo and supplies. I think they're going to get troops in there.
Yes, you know, Russia doesn't have a lot of friends, and Syria was a friend. They have a base there. It's not a very big base. It's just the place where they dock their military ships in the Mediterranean. And they want that toehold because they need warm water ports, and that's why they're supporting Assad. Now, Putin, who's been in power for a very long time, since 2000, has watched the West change their mind and go hard, go weak, go strong,
that's
run
right.
away, come back. And he knows the game, so he basically is in there for the duration. And he knows, as he knows in Ukraine and other places, that if you just slowly start taking back what you want, the West will always fold and run away.
Well, he knows that we've got our hands tied with so many other things. And here's a big issue. I mean, how can Secretary of State John Kerry scream at the Russian foreign minister about what they're doing in Syria when we're doing the same things in Iraq and Afghanistan and God knows where? What grounds do we have to tell them to get out?
Well, we're caught in a trap. I mean, the biggest weakness of America, and we can argue this all night, is that we change directions every 8 years. So, you know, we go hard and strong, and we become sort of aggressive promoters of democracy for 8 years under Republicans, and then we run in the opposite direction, and we use diplomacy and soft power, and we lose all those gains, and then we reverse again. And what happens is that whether that's right or wrong, people don't view us as full-time partners. So in Syria, we supported Assad because he was the reformer, believe it or not. You know, the father was the tough guy. The tough guy's son got killed in his Ferrari on the way to the airport.
Mm-hmm,
so
that's right.
The ophthalmologist was put in charge of the country. And just before the uprising, you know, they were doing articles in Vanity Fair and all these fashion magazines promoting their liberal sort of Western agenda in Syria, and they were opening up the country. So, you know, it runs hot and cold. So bottom line is that America has to stay either strong or get out of these places. And we've done a little bit of everything in Syria.
I think so, too. And it's getting to the point, too, where what we want to do is protect Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. Gosh, we haven't heard anything about Kuwait since 1991, practically, have we?
No, because they're all in the discos in London.
No, you're right. You're right about that. So let me ask you about Iran. I mean, today, the Ayatollah Khamenei screams that Israel's got 25 years left. That's it for them. They'll be destroyed. Death to America. So he's doing all this rhetoric. How can we cut a nuke deal with them when this guy is spouting what he spouts?
Well, Israel has nuclear weapons, and Iran doesn't. Secondly, Iran has been both our partner and our enemy, depending on who runs the country. It has been a fixation of the U.S. State Department for many years, ever since the embassy takeover and the rise of mm-hmm. the fundamentalists. But the belief that we have is that within the population of Iran, which once again, like Syria, is very educated, they're not hardliners. If we can just get rid of these ayatollahs, then it'll become sort of a new fountainhead of creativity and business and, of course, oil. The problem is we go about it very crudely. We're running insurgencies in the south. We're supporting people to go put car bombs and assassinate people inside Iran. And, of course, Israel has a huge lobby in which they constantly portray Iran as the next Iraq. You know, and this is one of the reasons we went into Iraq, is because of the threat to Israel. So, once again, Iran is put up as a huge threat to America, when in actual fact they're just defending themselves from our constant, sort of covert activity we do inside there.
I know many Iranians who live here in Southern California. They call themselves Persians, primarily. Mm-hmm. Great people. They love the United States. They're glad they live here. And they tell me that their friends and relatives that live in Iran love our Western way of life. You're absolutely right. It's these ayatollahs and these other people who are running the country that seem to be destroying everything for everybody.
Well, they're maintaining a fiction that their problems are caused by America. And, you know, Fidel Castro in Cuba is a very good example of where we were taught for years and years and years that they were going to be a threat to America and that they're run by this brutal dictatorship. And, of course, all the Canadian tourists go there and go, hey, this place is great. So we've created a huge fictional enemy that has attacked us and has supported, you know, various terrorist groups. But the reality is they will evolve. We just have to let them evolve.
All right. Stay with us, Robert. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Then we shall be right back talking with you more about what is happening worldwide. Next hour, we'll take phone calls. Robert Young Pelton is a long way away, folks. He's on the border of Italy and Slovenia. That's pretty far. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Robert Young Pelton. We will take your calls with Robert next hour. Robert, we are coming up Friday on the 14th anniversary of one of our darkest moments, 9/11, of course. Are we safer or are we still in a very precarious situation?
Well, I'm always asked to comment on 9/11 and the meaning. And you know, I spent a lot of time with jihadis and people like bin Laden's groups before 9/11. And we always had these terror attacks. And they were conducted by some by American ex-vets, some by foreigners. So I think it was the first time we lived in a random world. We realized that, that these attacks happen all the time by various groups and that in a safe society, you can't prevent a crazy guy from doing something violent. So I think we live in the same world. I think we tried to go over to Afghanistan and we failed to go into Pakistan and we went to Iraq and we failed to go in Iran. So we can't fix terrorist attacks by attacking other countries. What we can do is use what we have always used, which is a strong system of friends and neighbors to know who's among you. And this is the one thing that is common to almost all attacks, is the lone wolf or the loner concept. If we don't know who lives down the street or who is on the bus with us, then we're prey to these type of attacks.
But could we have another attack like we had during that horrible day where they hijacked planes, rammed them into buildings? And, you know, I know there's a camp of people, and we've talked about it on this program, who believe in controlled demolition and everything else. Not, I'm not ruling anything out, but... Yeah. I mean, are there still groups out there that can put that kind of plan together?
Of course. I mean, it cost about $450,000. It was put together by a disgruntled guy who went to school in the States. It was reported, all the guys coming over that wanted to learn how to fly a plane but not land it, was reported to the FBI and numerous law enforcement. We had full warning that something very odd was going to happen. What we didn't understand was the bizarreness of hijacking planes and flying them into buildings, because it made no sense to us. And this is the key to these random attacks, is that we're always looking for the last attack. So the next attack will be something we don't expect. And it doesn't take that much to cause major casualties in a large nation.
And when a person is prepared to die, like these hijackers were, like a suicide shoe bomber would do, it's very difficult to stop that.
Well, it actually, you know, my specialty is understanding these cults. And you got to remember, they are cults. And the key to getting someone to blow themselves up is to separate them from sort of the Maslow hierarchy of needs, where most people want to be alive. Most people want to be healthy, happy.
Of course.
And what you do is you isolate them, you prey on their weaknesses, and you teach them to do the opposite. You know, you say dying is good, killing is good. And we have these groups, many of them, where they go over to the Middle East and then they fight in Syria and they believe in a sort of very nihilistic view of the world. The trick is to remember these are small groups and they can easily be detected. We shouldn't put overall labels on entire groups, religions, or whatever, but at the same time, once again, look for the signs. It's fairly easy to understand who these people are.
Are they growing young children into becoming these kinds of people who will commit suicide at a whim?
Of course, and this is part of the cult attitude. You know, Osama bin Laden, when he created Al-Qaeda, the first thing he did was look for people's weaknesses and then get them over to remote camps in Pakistan where they would, you know, lecture them every single day on the fictional evils of the West, and then prepare them for killing themselves as if it was a good thing. And the bottom line is that you're always going to have this. You always have had this. We just haven't seen it globally.
So do you anticipate anything?
Right now, I think that we are not going to have any major. I mean, the number of casualties was astounding in 9/11, 3,000
people. 3,000 people.
but I don't think we're going to see anything more than, let's say, a couple of hundred people, because that's about the most you can kill using ready-made explosives. So will there be events throughout the world? Yes. Will they happen in America? Probably not to the extent that they will happen in Europe, but you saw with the two Chechen brothers where they took a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
The same bomb that was put under my table in Uganda by Islamic rebels. It's been around for years. You can still make those kind of bombs. Everybody's got a barbecue. Everybody can buy gasoline. I mean, there's no limits to what you can do with small improvised explosives.
Well, and you don't have to kill a lot of people to create that kind of terror that would race through society, because social networking picks up the ball, good or bad.
And then, you know, you bring up a very good point, because I'll say there's two things happening. We have excellent security professionals who know what to look for. We have some pretty comfortable feelings when we go to a big football game, you know, a big political rally. And at the same time, the media has not accepted that professional mandate by saying, look, if one guy blows his brains out on a freeway, it does not need to be national news. You know, if one guy puts a small bomb or goes into a school and shoots people, we don't need to elevate them into national or international heroes or anti-heroes. And this is the problem, is that ISIS is using films of snuff films of murders and getting more and more creative to get them played around the world. I mean, I couldn't get a message of peace and hope played around the world as much as ISIS can with a beheading.
And let me ask you about these beheadings. They march these people down to the shoreline on a beach, and then they cut their heads off. And all of them, Robert, seem so calm, so at ease, and you got to believe that they knew something was going to happen. I don't know. There's something weird there.
Well, I know quite a bit about this. And in the old days, I'm talking about the 90s, they used to inject them with a sedative. And they become sort of very passive, and they don't have a sense of fear. Yeah, today, what they do is they condition you. They put a sedative in you, but in your food. But at the same time, they say, okay, we're going to go make a video. And they get very nervous, and they say, no, we're just going to make this video. We're going to pretend like this and that. And I'm going to hold a knife, and then they put them back in the cell. Then they come out, and they do it again, and they do it again, and they do it again. It's cult training. You're training somebody to say, you have to stay alive by doing this. Don't worry, I'm your friend.
And then on the fifth time, on cue, they cut their heads off.
Well, not only that, but you haven't actually seen their physical heads being cut off. There was a ranger who was executed who had all kinds of contusions and bruises and was most likely shot before they cut his head off. So a lot of these people did fight. But at the same time, it's a very conditioned way to project a cinematic sense of gore. And this is my point, is, you know, thousands of people die every day around the world. They manage to get maximum publicity and fear with a single beheading because it goes directly to the media's biggest fear.
Do you see the day where governments will literally shut down social networks?
No, but I think there's an appropriate level of censorship for people who are projecting violence into your home. You know, you remember when Hollywood first started in the 30s, they had all kinds of shootings, they had sex, and people actually rebelled against all that sort of lasciviousness, and they formed this sort of self-censorship of films, which exists to this day, which is the rating system and whatever. I think the media could be charged with the idea that, okay, fine, you can broadcast this, but it is considered propaganda. It is considered a terrorist act to project to a young child the murder, the rape, the killing of an innocent person, specifically to cause terror. Just like dropping a bomb or putting a bomb in somebody's school is an act of terror. I think these are visual and mental acts of terror.
Robert Young Pelton with us, his website, of course, a few of them all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. What's going on with that whack job in North Korea?
Oh, come on. He provides more entertainment than any other leader.
That's true.
He's kind of stuck. Yeah, he doesn't have a lot of money. He has to blame everything on the West. He has to put on those wonderful parades. I don't know if you ever watched those parades.
I've seen a few of them. They're pretty spectacular.
Re-edited to disco music. There's nothing better than that. But at some point, he will fail, just like Iran will fall. You know, the old guard, the idea of socialism, Marxism, it's not a workable structure anymore. And once North Korea is open, and by the way, you can go to North Korea now on tours. If you go there, you'll find that it's just a really boring place. And there's no reason to fear it. There's no reason to get all excited about it. It's just a bankrupt little tin pot country.
Is it true that he kills off his uncles and other people that seem to fall asleep in meetings and things like that?
Some of those are true, but a lot of them is just that ridiculous fiction they put out there. You know, we want to hate dictators, right? So when we depose them, we think, oh, that guy was a crazy guy, he was a bad guy. And you'll see that every strong man has the same PR and machine working against him. But, you know, he didn't get elected to that job, let's put it that way. And he's got a great collection of looking at stuff pictures, which I noticed that President Obama is now copying. The point is, it's all about image, right? It's not about, we're not going to get attacked by North Korea anytime soon.
So, Robert, you're in Italy. You're off the border of Slovenia. What are you doing out there?
I'm going to watch a drone demonstration by it's a Swiss company, and they make some innovative rotor-type drones. And we use drones, we use Schiebel S-100 camcopters, which is a sort of a modified military-type drone, off the deck of the Phoenix, which is the ship that we use to rescue people off the coast of Libya. So drone manufacturers are very interested in showing us the new technology and what they can do.
How big are the drones?
They're about 12 feet long, 10 feet long, and they have I think it's a Rotax engine, and they can go out about 100 miles, and what they allow us to do is find these tiny boats in this huge sea and get to them before they're all screaming and dying and drowning. And drones are the future, you know. It's a fascinating new segment in which, when you talk about terrorist attacks, you know, I predict that some of the worst terrorist attacks are going to be carried out by remotely programmed drones.
I think you're right. That kind of technology is here, and it's just a matter of, you know, it's going to be very difficult. How do you shoot down a drone, for crying out loud?
Well, you don't even know it's there. And one of the things that, not my generation has to deal with it, but the next generation is, everything's going to be automated. Everything's going to be controlled by software, by programmers. And then you've got hackers, you know. So you've got everything from your car to your computer to your television is run by a computer that people won't understand and that may or may not do what you want it to do. So drones are a very frightening new development because, you know, they have remotely piloted aircraft. Imagine you could take off from New York and land in Los Angeles and not have a pilot in the cockpit. And this is all possible now.
I'm not sure I'd want to get on that kind of plane, but you're right.
Well, most people never see the pilot. Remember, he's locked inside that cockpit.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that it's a new world, and these terrorist groups are looking at this brave new world and how to defeat it. So don't be surprised if you see a lot of technology involved in the next attacks.
Tell me a little bit about this rescuing people at sea. Is that a big situation?
Well, what happens is, as you know, Libya fell apart, and there isn't a lot of law and order.
Right.
And people from the Middle East and people from Africa want to get to Europe so they can go straight through Libya. There's a smuggling organization that takes them all the way from, let's say, Somalia or Central African Republic or from Syria. They have these nasty old fishing boats, which they buy in Egypt and Tunisia. They cram anywhere from 300 to 800 people on these boats, and they give them a compass, and they tell them to go north. And then when they get past the Bouri oil fields, which is the international waters, they call in for an SOS, and usually commercial ships used to rescue them. And then last year they had the Navy out there. And this year there was nobody out there. So Regina and Christopher Cantraboni bought a Alaskan fishing trawler. Christopher's American, Regina's Italian. With the very apolitical view of, we can't watch these people drown. So they pull these people out of the water, and then the Italians direct them on where to take them. So it's a coordinated rescue. And this year we've got Medicine Sans Frontières on the boat providing medical care. And we have a perfect safety record, unlike a lot of the rescue vessels. Nobody's drowned, nobody's died during the rescue, but it's because there is no other people out there. Or if, let's say, a commercial oil tanker is in the area, they'll say, okay, hey, oil tanker, with your 70-foot-high sides, go try to rescue these 400 people in a rubber raft, and it doesn't work out that well sometimes.
What drives you, Robert? I mean, you are on some incredible adventures.
Well, I multitask. I mean, I'm still dealing. I'm doing my Finding Coney, Joseph Coney. I'm heading down to Kafia Kingi, where Coney is, this winter. I'm working with MOAS to rescue people to show that the Europe has basically failed. You know, they can't control their borders, and they're trying to use the Mediterranean as a moat. I make knives with DPX gear for special operations teams and special forces. And I write books. So there's just a lot of things I got to get done. I just turned 60 this year.
Well, happy birthday, belatedly.
So I never expected to be alive this long, but I'm really enjoying myself.
Make a prediction for us, Robert. The next couple years, what do you see?
I think people are going to seriously question borders and restrictions on travel. I think the economy is going to be healthy and that people will start looking globally to sell their skills. We have a lot of talented people in America that used to come from poor places. I see them going off and working around the world. And I see a lot of simmering, stupid, ugly wars that just continue without any end or any resolution. And you see how long we've been in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I see people being stressed if they don't get out there and understand that war is a natural state for many of these places. You know, that we shouldn't worry about a war in South Sudan. We shouldn't worry about a war in Afghanistan because it may be unsolvable. It may be the natural structure of those borders.
I feel so sorry for some of these people that you see homeless, involved in these situations. They're in a cafe and somebody blows it up. It's heartbreaking. These are real souls. These are people that are hurting all around this planet, and it just seems like there's nothing we're doing about that.
Well, what I'm seeing is the need for globalization, which sounds a little scary to people, but you know, there are people that are homeless in areas where there's empty apartment buildings.
Yes.
You know, we have the entire city of Detroit waiting for somebody to fix it up, and we have hundreds of thousands of Syrians, of people with skills who want to find a place to home, you know, want a place to build and to start businesses. I was in Liberia during the war in which there was nothing, and people would instantly form little markets and businesses and, you know, instantly take something from nothing. So I feel very good about what people can do. What I don't like is the fact that we create artificial borders that prevent good things from happening.
Would you take the borders down between the U.S. and Mexico?
Well, they already are down.
Yeah, they are.
Mexico
technically
is commuted back and forth between Mexico and America. They just paid the coyote more money when they put up the wall. So it's a fiction to think that our borders are closed, they're open, they're porous. We benefit by those people being here, and of course, sometimes we don't benefit by, you know, foreigners being here. But at the end of the day, it's a fiction to think that a line that's drawn on a map will stop somebody from crossing that border.
Robert, don't you think the most dramatic thing we can do to change things is legalize all drugs so most of these problems seem to go away?
You know, you bring up a good point there, because whether it's smuggling migrants or drugs, or it's the same thing, it's the same business. And so these borders actually corrupt our border control people. And if you wonder how people can get across the border at these very high security areas, it's because there's corruption there. And if we remove the criminal incentive and we control the movement or the production or the sale of something, it becomes, strangely enough, an asset to the economy, and it removes the illicit appeal of some of these things.
Yeah, I had a couple border patrol guys who listen to our program all the time down in McAllen, Texas. Great guys. And they said, boy, could I tell you some things. We're going to come back in a moment. Robert Young-Pelton with us. One more hour. It's time for your phone calls.